This is a continuation of the interview with Irv Luton in the Jefferson Room at the Oregon Historical Society, and the date is March 14th, is that right?
Right.
1989. The interviewer is Jim Strassmeyer for the Oregon Historical Society. And I think that our tape level is satisfactory. We really stopped right in the middle of your war experiences, and I wondered if we could highlight some of these experiences. And was it Fort Dix that
I think in our last interview I stopped where we had been at Camp Hood, Texas, and we had gone at Christmas time to Fort Dix, and we were scheduled to go overseas, and that's why we were sent to Fort Dix. It was the staging area. And then they decided, the Allied Expeditionary Forces decided that they needed Air Force rather than tank destroyer. So they canceled our going over to North Africa. And we were sent to Pine Camp, New York, to do some additional training and wait to go overseas. And this was in the spring of 1943. We were sent to Pine Camp. And, I guess it was in sort of midwinter, 1943. Maybe it might have been January, February, somewhere along in there, because I can remember there was still snow at Pine Camp. And we were sent there. And I was then the military intelligence officer of the tank destroyer battalion. S2 is what they identify an intelligence officer with. When we arrived at Pine Camp, I received orders from the G2 of the Corps, and that was, I think it was a Corps, it might have been an Army Administrative District, but the G2 was an intelligence officer, that I should report all kinds of security lapses, security violations, not through channels, but directly to that G2. So we trained at Pine Camp, and about June of 43, May of 43, we received orders that we should start, be prepared to go overseas. And I found out from some of the officers that girlfriends of theirs, I should explain, the Pine Camp was a place where there were a lot of women whose husbands were either gone overseas already. There were young women all ready to go out with officers and enlisted men too. And the military men certainly took advantage of this. And some of our officers all acquired girlfriends rather promptly at Pine Camp. Some of them were nurses, because there was a big nurses contingent that was stationed there ready to, in preparation for going overseas. And they heard that we were going to get orders to go overseas to England. And I knew there must be a leak somewhere. And then, maybe a week after we began to hear these things, the order came through to our colonel that we should begin getting the battalion ready to be staged, put on the railroad to go to New York to embark for overseas. So obviously somebody was talking. So I reported all of this, and there were a number of instances in which girlfriends of enlisted men were talking about it, girlfriends of our officers were talking about it, and it was generally known around the camp that we were about to go overseas. Well, this is the time, you know, when the Germans were getting a lot of the troop ships with those submarines they had, and this was certainly a violation of security.
So it was serious business.
So I reported this not through channels, but directly to G2. Then I reported something else, too. A contingent of nurses was scheduled to go over to England, and about a week before they were to go, the colonel who was in charge of Pine, who was in command of Pine Camp, the administrative setup of Pine Camp, New York, held a big farewell party for these nurses, which was just an outright violation of security. So I reported that to G2. Well, in June of 43, we were moved to New York for embarkation on Queen Mary, and we were arrived in England. I can't remember the date now, but I think it was the 23rd of June. We arrived in Scotland, and the Queen Mary was loaded with number of troops, but it was loaded to the gunwales. There was every bit of space was utilized, and it was just I don't know how many thousands of American troops on the Queen Mary. And I was given duty to one of the messes. And when what they had done is they took the big swimming pool, the Queen Mary, and turned it into a mess hall and built steps down into the swimming pool and steps on out to the swimming pool on the other end. And all these men would be fed there three times a day, and there had to be somebody to keep order, keep them in line, that sort of thing. So I was on duty there. I'd have about 10 hours of duty a day in that mess hall. I mean, fed all day long. There were that many troops on board. And the Queen Mary never needed an escort because it was so fast that it could zig and zag and keep ahead, keep the submarines couldn't catch it. But it was always zigging and zagging. And I can remember standing in that swimming pool. One moment I'd be looking up on my right, and here was the other side of the swimming pool was up there, and then pretty soon I was up there, and the other side of the swimming pool was down there. And sometimes I got pretty queasy. I never got seasick, but because of this zigging and zagging, a lot of people get very seasick. There was a lot of food smell that wasn't added to this that tended to make you queasy. But we arrived in England without any difficulty at all. So far as I know, I don't know that there was ever any danger of a submarine ever zeroing in on us or not. And then we disembarked at,
Southampton?
No, this was up in Scotland. Can't think of the name of it now. I know it so well, too. Starts with G. But anyway, we arrived there at about 2 a.m. in the morning. And I was fascinated with this because I had never realized that Glasgow, Scotland, that's where it was so far north that at 2 a.m. in the morning with double daylight saving time that you had during the war, the sun was still up. And it was quite a little way from going down. It was just broad daylight, you know, right. 2 a.m. in the morning. And it never occurred to me that Glasgow was that far north, you know. Well, from there we were sent down to Swindon, which is sort of mid England. Went down by train, and we were put up in some Nissen huts, a camp there in the mid England, and we trained there. And we would take these tank destroyers down to Land's End, which is the far western point of England, southwestern point of England. And the targets would be towed in the ocean. And that's what we would shoot at with these 90 millimeter guns on these tank destroyers. I think you mentioned something about, well, what was my feeling about, well, being in the service and all that sort of thing. Well, I was a reserve officer, so I felt I should go right away, and I think I've already covered that. And I felt that I had a duty to go. I, like most people, I think, who were scheduled to go overseas and who were in the in any of the military branches, and were scheduled to go into combat, felt that we might never come back. So there was a tendency on the part of officers and enlisted men to live for today, never think much about tomorrow. Which led to, I think, some excessive drinking, for one thing. I remember when we were at Fort Dix, and we'd all go down to the officers' club every night. And I'm sure when we came back, we were pretty well looped. And you'd go to the officers' club, and there wasn't much to do but to drink or play cards or play slot machines, and unless they had a dance or something like that, and they had one once in a while. But there was a lot of drinking. And I think it was because men who were married took refuge in drinking because they were away from their families and their wives, and they didn't feel very good about that. So it was, I suppose, a way to forget that. The unmarried had this feeling that, well, I probably never come back, I'll never have a life, where I'll have a family and all that sort of thing, and so I'm going to have a good time right now. And so there was a lot of excessive drinking, and I think womanizing as well. I didn't do much of the latter, but a lot of people did. There were a lot of married men that played around on their wives during the war, and I think one of the things that caused that was this feeling, well, you know, I just never will come back from this thing. You know, and you read about how successful the German army was, and you saw it on movies, and how efficient that army was, and you knew how well protected the European continent was against an invasion. And so you could picture what would happen in an invasion, which was that there were a lot of people who were going to get killed. So everybody was sort of living for today.
Mm-hmm. Well, were you on the way to being married at this time?
No, no.
Made any...
Well, I had...
In that direction?
Yes, I had a girlfriend from Spokane. Her name was Jane Robinson, and I would have married her had it not been that I felt that I might never come back. And as a matter of fact, after I got over on the continent, I still felt that way, even after the invasion. And it bothered me so much that I wrote her a letter and sort of ended it saying that I don't think I'll ever want to get married. Later, I think I kind of regretted that. later I did regret that. But that was the kind of feeling you had, because you didn't want to leave a wife, you know, and children and all that sort of thing, when you felt that you may never come back, you know.
Another aspect of it that occurs to me is that the your self-direction, the running of your own life, has been in certain ways stopped. You don't have direction of your own life. What's it like living in that circumstance?
Well, I think I don't know whether all people would feel this way or not. But what happens is when you're in an army unit or a marine unit or whatever it is, you build up a loyalty to that unit, especially if it is a good one and it gets good marks from the higher command. You build up a loyalty to it, and it's a sort of like belonging to a great football team or a great basketball team or something like that. And that becomes very important. And I suppose that's why men can go to war and fight as they do, is that you have this feeling that people depend on you in your unit, and you cannot do things that would embarrass your unit commander or embarrass your unit, the reputation of your unit. And there's a camaraderie that builds up among the officers, and I'm sure the same thing happens among the enlisted men. And you become very proud of belonging to that unit. And that kind of carries you through. Well, that has been my experience, at least. I never really got into heavy combat of any kind. And maybe people who had been in a lot of combat might have felt differently about that. I don't know, but you get a feeling sometimes. I did when we would, let's say, be marching in parade or something, that you were just a little bit taller than you ever were before, and you felt a real thrill of belonging to this unit and having command of something in that unit.
That's part of the meaning, too, of military discipline?
I guess so, yeah. Well, at any rate, we were stationed at Swindon, and we were doing this training down in Land's End, and then some right around Swindon on land. And then I was assigned to be the defense counsel for our battalion. And when somebody was court-martialed, I would defend them in the court-martial. And the court-martial proceedings were all forwarded to Corps, to the judge advocate in the Corps. Judge advocate is the one who, maybe you understand what that is. It's the officer who has charge of legal matters in the Corps. And I had prevailed in a couple of court martials when somebody was accused, I defended them. I had prevailed because I knew my Army regulations. And one instance, for example, is a man who happened to be from Tacoma, Washington, who was confined to quarters for something he had done. And my best friend was the commander of the company that had confined him was commander of his company. And he was the one who gave the order that he should be confined to quarters. Well, when I investigated it, I found out that he himself had not restricted this sergeant who had gone off when he was to town when he was confined to quarters, but he had his first sergeant do it. Well, Army regulations state specifically that only the company commander can restrict, can punish an enlisted man or anyone. The company commander has to give that punishment himself. He cannot pass it on to his first sergeant and say, I want that man restricted. So I had to get my best friend on the stand and ask him if he had restricted this man, and he hummed and said, well, yes, he had.
He knew what you were doing.
He had the first sergeant do it, and well, of course, he was acquitted. Well, I think it was some things like that that led CORE to appoint me as the Assistant Defense Counsel of CORE. Why, I don't know, because there were attorneys around, but the defense counsel himself was an attorney. But I was appointed as an assistant defense counsel. And we defended a couple of cases, and the most prominent one was one of a sergeant who was supposedly had raped a British girl. And I've forgotten the name of the town where this occurred. It doesn't make any difference. But I was asked by the defense counsel, who was an attorney, to investigate it. And so I got an English bobby and asked him if he would come with me. And we went to the site where this rape was supposed to have taken place. And it was in a park. But the park was surrounded with a barbed wire entanglement. So the question was, well, how did this guy get this girl inside the park through this barbed wire entanglement? And obviously, he couldn't have forced her through it. Or if he had, she would have been scratched to pieces, you know. So the English bobby was brought, when they had the trial, the English bobby was brought on the stand. We asked him to describe the premises, which he did. Then we got the girl on the stand and asked her, well, how did this man gets you into the park, this sergeant? Well, she just really had trouble answering that. And it finally came down to, well, did you go through first, or did he drag you through? No, I went through first. And, you know, I looked at the court-martial board, and I knew we had it won right there. And then afterwards, she said, well, I was afraid of him. I went through first, but I was afraid of him. That's why I went through. But we knew we had him acquitted when she admitted that. And I think what really happened was that she probably kind of went along with it, and then it got to the point where he was really wanting to have intercourse with her, why she probably backed off. And he backed off. But you see, this was an important case, but because in the Army, a rape does not require penetration. An attempted rape is rape, and it can carry the death sentence. So it was a pretty important case.
Pretty severe law in the military.
Well, I enjoyed doing that very much. And one of the things I considered before I came home after the war was whether I shouldn't go back to school and take law. And I'll tell you later it will come out as to what happened. You know, I never did, but...
So you seriously thought of it?
Yeah. Because I did enjoy doing that. Well, then we were finally moved to Barnstable, England, which is on the west coast of England, and it's a quaint little town. Has some real old Victorian homes and estates where they had fox hunts and that sort of thing. Quaint little place. And at that place, we were there for... Well, I know we were there until January of 44. And I think we were moved there probably sometime like September of 43 or something like that. And we had officers' quarters in a great big old estate, about a four-story Victorian house, brick. And we had an officers' club downstairs for our own officers. Not much of a club, really. It's just sort of a place where we could get around the fireplace and night and relax and that sort of thing. And then we slept upstairs in the bedrooms, and they had big French windows that looked out on the garden. This was an old building, quite run down. Gardens hadn't been very well taken care of. And what was the name of it? Well, it doesn't make any difference. It had an estate name on it. Again, while you're waiting like this, when a unit is waiting to get into combat, it's just training, it gets kind of boring for a lot of the men. And so again, there was a lot of excessive drinking. There was some at Swindon, and there was some at Fort Dix. And to give you an incident of this, at Fort Dix, we had a man named Casey, who had been a school teacher prior to the war, Lieutenant Casey. And we went over to the officers' club one night, and we all drank quite a bit. And we were all sleeping in a great big room on cots. And I came home earlier than most of them, and I'm sure I had enough to drink that I went to sleep pretty soundly. I woke up the next morning, and I thought, my gosh, these covers feel tight, and here was this guy Casey in bed with me. I don't know when he got in there. He didn't know later on. His cot was close to mine, and he got into my cot. And I woke up, and I said, Casey, what are you doing in this bed? Get the hell out of here. And then other officers awakened, you know, and you can imagine why they kidded us like hell about this, you know. But you know, this was the sleeping bag that we were in, and he crawls into the sleeping bag with me. Well, when we were at Barnstable, the same Casey goes out and on the town, and he's drinking at some of the pubs, And so he comes to bed, and we're all sound asleep by the time he comes to bed. And then sometime during the night, I think it was about 3 a.m, he had to go to the bathroom, and there was no bath there. There was no toilet up on that floor. So he didn't want to go downstairs or to the toilet. So he opens up these French windows, and he's going to pee out of the window. And then the next thing we heard, and we weren't even aware of that, but the thing that awakened us was somebody down below crying, help. And he had fallen out of the window and broken his arm in the garden. Well, it was while we were at Barnstable that, a rather interesting thing happened. There was a man named Bruce Bairnsfather who was a well-known British cartoonist and also a British playwright. After World War I, he had written a play that had grossed, I don't know how much in England, but it grossed $1 million on Broadway, which was unheard of at that time in this country. Grossed $1 million. And it was called The Better Whole, or as he entitled it, The Better Ole, meaning The Better Foxhole. And I don't know, he wrote several other plays. Well, During that period, World War II, he was doing cartoons for Stars and Stripes. So he came down to our battalion because we were the first tank destroyer battalion to arrive in England, and so he wanted to do something on a tank destroyer battalion. And so he came down and did some cartoons. And one that I remember is that showed a tank destroyer backed up to a stream and a guy was fishing with the aerial of the tank destroyer out of this stream. Well, while he was doing these cartoons, he and I became very friendly. And so when